In 1977, the White Sox, with whom I labored at the time, had a promotion with disco clubs all around Chicago. And at the end of the evening, Jeff Schwartz, who was a record plugger at that time for United Artists, and a group of us retired to Miller's Pub, which I'm happy to say still stands in downtown Chicago. And we discussed what we thought was a blight on the American music scene, disco. And we thought it would be really fun to have a night honoring rock and roll music for all the people who didn't care for disco and loved rock and roll. We went home laughing at 4 a.m. and never thought about it again until Steve Dahl on WLUP blew up a disco record. And about 5 minutes after Mr. Dahl got off the air, I called him and said, "You want to do that live at Comiskey Park?" And he said, "Well, I've only done it at shopping centers." And I said, "Well, go practice, because we're going to do it between games of a Twi-Night doubleheader against the Tigers." And so July 12th came, and I told everyone we were going to have 35,000 people, and they thought that was the funniest thing they ever heard. And there were 35,000 people lined up at 3 o'clock. So we opened the gates at 4 o'clock. It was a Twi-Night doubleheader, a long extinct. You'll never see one of those again, except for two admissions. And we opened the gates. There were 60,000 people in Comiskey by 6 o'clock. And after losing the first game, the kids ran out on the field.
It's not a scene that I want to remember very long.
No, not for in baseball. And I certainly hope that there's an example being made here that something like this will never happen again, not only for this ballpark, but for all ballparks around the country.
As they say, the rest is history. Jane Byrne wrote in. The riot squad came in after an hour. We were forced to forfeit. My dad looked at me and said, "Every once in a while, you have one that works too well." He was actually the only one who understood it. It did not do wonders for my baseball career from there on.
You sort of went on a bit of a downward spiral after that personally. I mean, that emotionally, yeah, you know, those were some tough times for you following that event.
That's putting it mildly. I just went right off the deep end, ran right off the deep end. You know, you're hearing on the street behind your back purportedly that this would cost your potentially Hall of Fame father. It was a disgrace. And of course, I didn't know what a slow news day meant, which meant that everybody wrote about it. Had there been something else going on, it would have been relegated, you know, to maybe not so large an amount of coverage. But I hit the sauce pretty good after that, and didn't work again in the big leagues for 10 years.
The fact that you had to forfeit the second game of a doubleheader, that's especially in the 79 season, that wasn't such a big issue, I guess, for the White Sox, but there was some cost involved in that, and I'm sure that created some issues for your father as well.
Oh, yeah, it's a marketing man's nightmare, actually, to have a promotion that goes, as I said, almost too well. Too many people show up, and you end up forfeiting what was then only the fourth game in the history of Major League Baseball. And there comes a a real onus with that. But I refused then, John, to apologize in terms of this being a terrible tragedy. You know, I know what tragedies are. We all know what tragedies are. We see them every day. Those are veterans who don't have enough to eat, or children who can't walk. Those are tragedies. Causing the forfeiture of a ball game doesn't rate very high up there. That was all I said, and of course the press just killed me for that. But now I'm happy to say that ever since the 25th anniversary, people kind of look back on this event now with kind of a warm and fuzzy approach, as opposed to the first 10 or 15 years in which I was a pariah.
You've been in baseball probably about as long as your father was, yet I assume you're still recognized more likely as Bill Veeck's son. Does that get frustrating for you at times?
Oh, you go through your periods. That had a lot to do with my drinking and you know, your maturity level. I mean, I'm a mistake of genetics. You know, if I had been Charlie Brown, not the famous one, I would have gotten another chance after disco, and Dad was not well-liked in the front office. So the name Beck was not helpful to getting employment. But the fans loved it, and I know which one I'd choose, and it was easy being his kid because there was never any money. He died broke, but not broken. And I think kids who have famous parents who have a lot of money to worry about have a problem. But I think when it's just infamy, you don't really have a problem. And I've had a wonderful, you know, run. I've worked for 4.5 major league teams. I've owned a dozen or so minor league teams. I've got 10 years in the bigs, 25 years in the minors. So I have managed to have a dream life with very mediocre talent.
I've never thought your father gets his due for contributions to baseball. He was seemed to be all about having fun, giving fans a good time, you know, making the game more about, you know, an enjoyable experience out there rather than people just sitting in the seats all the time. And that's an approach you've honed as well with your ownership. Talk a little about your leadership style when it comes to baseball.
Hire good people and stay out of their way. Listen to the fans. Make sure that any decision you make is for the fans first. And I appreciate your comments about my old man. He made a lot of contributions to the game. And unfortunately, you know, because of Eddie Goodell, the midget in St. Louis, a lot of the facts that he won a world championship in Cleveland in 1948 with Lou Boudreau and a pennant on the south side of Chicago with the White Sox in 1959, are lost because he was so unpopular with the owners. And they would like to have him remembered as a man of gimmicks instead of as a Renaissance man of substance he made to the game. The game, I might add, that he loved, and it was the only way he made his living. He didn't inherit money. He had no money except what he earned at the box office.
Now, you mentioned doing everything for the fans. You had one night, though, with one of your minor league teams more recently where you locked the fans out of the stadium. You set a record for lowest attendance at a game. What would your dad have thought about that?
I think he'd have laughed. You know, I'd have been a fool not to learn a little something. And the juxtaposition of ideas and the idea that we spend all day, every day, laboring to draw the most people we can, that's what we kill ourselves all the time. So I just thought that the opposite would be kind of funny. And whether or not any of the purists agree, we did do 126 interviews all over the world, and HBO came and did a 12-minute special on it. So I stand by Nobody Night. Silly but effective.
You're sort of in the entertainment business as well as the baseball business. Can some of what you preach also apply to other businesses and people in other fields?
Well, I didn't really think about it. You know, I could never work in the hockey business. I could never work in the basketball business just because baseball is so ingrained and it's what I love. My son, Night Train, for example, is fourth generation now working for the White Sox. That's kind of our game. But a few years ago, I wrote a book called Fun is Good, and the people who responded to the book were businesses all over the country. And I did some touring around and speaking for corporations, and it never really occurred to me that you could apply it. But the long-winded answer is yes, it really does work if you have a fun, creative shop, no matter what you do. You can make widgets or you can peddle baseball.